Well, here we are on the main course. It's Sunday, sometime in late September, and we are broadcasting from Roberta's. And
it's October.
It's October. Oh, man. I never know the days, but I know, you know, I know Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, but I don't know what day it coordinates with. But well, we have a great show. We're going to have Dr. Marion Nessel on the show, and then we're going to have Michelle Petrullio, who is the head chef of one of your favorite restaurants, Katie, the meatball shop.
Absolutely.
Talk about how cheap they're able to make their delicious food.
Yeah, well, we can talk about that a little more because I think cheap and delicious is kind of what everybody's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Our show today is sponsored by White Oak Pastures, Patrick.
Very nice.
White Oak Pastures cattle are raised in a manner that has stood the test of time. It begins with southern sunshine, unpolluted country air, and fertile coastal soil. The cattle are allowed to roam the pastures and graze freely on sweet native grasses all of their lives. White Oak Pastures all-natural grass-fed beef has been available in all of the Whole Foods stores in the mid-Atlantic states, and we hope that you will support their program through your purchase of their beef through one of these Whole Foods stores. For more information, go to www.whiteoakpastures.com.
Well, I'm a really big fan of that guy's because, you know, he basically just says... you know, he looks, turns his back on all kind of infrastructure. I mean, and he builds it all himself. He doesn't rely on anyone else. So he builds slaughterhouse facilities and has the farms on his properties. So it's, he's now getting into ducks and geese. And that's very exciting to me because I tasted a goose two nights ago and it is
really
so delicious. It's like steak. You know, parts of it are exactly like steak. And then the sauce from it is like candy. I mean, it's really unlike any other poultry, and I think more Americans would love it. And the skin is so...
Oh, yeah.
It's the only poultry with back fat.
Yeah, and plus you can keep that fat forever and cook other things in it, and then they taste really good, too. That's the beauty of goose fat, which is used for, you know, like confit of this and confit of that. I mean, you can preserve almost anything in it.
Yeah, it's the most edible fat of any, including pig for me and all that.
Yeah, so and let me tell you, frying potatoes up in some goose fat is an exciting experience. It really is.
Sputter, sputter.
So, you know, just in terms of our intro, we're going to have Marion on in 2 minutes. But I just wanted to say I was watching the political shows this Sunday. And for the first time in a long time, it was fun to watch television. Fun to watch these political shows on NBC Meet the Press. You know, and why is it fun? Because Obama is starting to really come out and fight back. And he had some great lines like, the guy's state is on fire. And he still denies global warming.
I love that.
You know, and he's really starting to get into it. He's bringing humor into it, and he's being strong. And so it was actually really fun to watch the news for the first time in a long time.
He's finally channeling his inner Karl Rove.
Yes.
I've been waiting for that to come out, man. I mean, where is the Democratic Party equivalent of Karl Rove? They've been doing dirty politics for the last, what, 8 cycles.
We have our guys.
And somehow, yeah, well, I'd like to see that happen. And it's lovely to see Obama stepping up.
So, did you read the New York Times food section?
Well, I did read part of it this morning, yes. Do you mean the food section for Wednesday?
No, I
you
meant
mean the one that mentioned the Heritage Meat Shop?
No. I'm talking about the New York Times magazine.
Yeah, I did.
What were some of the articles? It was an all-food issue, right?
It was an all-food issue, and it had food culture, etiquette, restaurants, and then, of course, the things that interest me, policy, which it was a little, I thought, weak on, actually. And just saying. And then it had one little thing that I picked up on, which I thought would be fun to chat about with Marion when she comes, when we start with her, but about addictive foods and craving foods and what's the difference between the two. Okay. So, yeah, there was all of that. It was good that they did the section. They had Michael Pollan. I didn't read his piece.
I liked his piece. It was
Sam
a lot
Sifton's
of
piece either.
Q&As, and they really got into it. I mean, they asked him like 20 questions or 25 questions, and it really broad, and he made it very practical because, you know, they were practical questions. I thought that was very useful.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, they also had The Last Meal, which I didn't see that section of Alice and Mario.
I didn't see that, but did you know that they just recently banned The Last Meal in Texas for prisoners who were sentenced to death row?
Yeah.
Yeah, you saw that, right?
Because that one guy asked for way too much stuff. Yeah. There was one guy who just was like going crazy. Salisbury steak.
And then he refused to eat any of it.
Lobster.
Even so. Well, Governor Rick Perry has presided over more executions during his tenure as governor than any other governor in the history of capital punishment, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing? And he's running for president.
He's running
for
Should I play an applause for that?
Yeah.
Derek doesn't know where he stands. He's a proud independent. Well, let's take a 10-second break, and then we will come back with Dr. Marion Nessel.
The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Katie Kiefer, and my co-host is Patrick Martins. Our show is sponsored today by White Oak Pastures, and our guest in studio, live and in person, is Dr. Marion Nessel. Dr. Nessel is the Paulette Goddard Professor in the Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health, the department that she chaired from 1988 to 2003. And she is a professor of sociology at New York University. And Marion is also the author of Food Politics, Safe Food, What to Eat, and Feed Your Pet Right, among others. You write a regular column for the San Francisco Chronicle still. And she maintains a fantastic blog entitled Food Politics. And it is there that I went, Marion, to pick up on one of your latest rants and raves. And the latest blog is entitled Help Rescue the Government's Marketing to Kids Nutrition Standards. What's that all about?
Well, the government came out with all my rants, first of all. Yeah, the wonderful thing about
your rant.
The wonderful thing about having a blog is you get to say anything you
Absolutely.
Want anytime you want to. And
in your case, people actually listen and read it.
Some people do. They seem to. But that one was about the what's called the Interagency Working Group, which was a group of four government agencies which came out with nutrition standards for marketing to kids. And when I first saw the standards, I just laughed because I thought they were so generous. I thought any junk food could be marketed to kids under these standards. But, oh, I couldn't have been more wrong. I just could not have been more wrong. Apparently, the foods are so bad that the standards would have excluded hundreds and hundreds of products from the biggest food makers that exist. And the food industry's been fighting back really, really hard. So hard that there are rumors that the Obama administration is going to back off on these.
Unbelievable.
So now, when you say push hard, what does that mean? That means they basically contribute money to senators and House representatives' campaigns and say, we won't give it if you don't.
Well, that's certainly part of it, but probably in this case, they're meeting with White House officials and discussing with them the lack of scientific knowledge behind these. The first thing you always do is you attack the science.
Okay.
That's step one. Step two is you talk about the effects of this on a very important industry to the American public. And in this particular case, the industries have gotten together with a lobbying effort that says that if these standards go through, 74,000 jobs will be lost.
I found that absolutely an astonishing claim. Now, let's get to that in a minute. But I mean, first of all, let's point out that these are voluntary.
Oh, yes, I forgot about that.
These
were voluntary guidelines, right?
Nobody They're had not to even mm-hmm. legislated. There's right. no law that says or regulation that says you must do or not do this or that.
Yeah, but what the industry says is that this is the camel's nose under the tent, and that the minute the evil government gets these voluntary guidelines in place, they're going to make them regulatory.
I see.
I don't see any signs of that in this administration. I don't think so. But the industry must be really, really worried about
yeah.
it, because if they can't market these products to kids, nobody would buy these things if they weren't marketed.
Well, don't you think that peer groups influence what children buy just as much as advertising on television and stuff?
Well, they do, but the peers are influenced
by the
advertising
yeah.
as well.
I mean, I'm just, you know, it's hard to know which, because now I see, I watch kids on the street. I have a teenager at home. I mean, they're not really like tuning into the heavy duty advertising because they're out on the street. They're doing their thing with each other, but they're buying Doritos by the boatload
as if they were watching
Cartoon Network addicts like they were when they were
little
kids.
Yeah, but they're watching Doritos marketed everywhere. The stuff is on their cell phones. It's mm-hmm. an electronic
It has
way.
Very shiny packaging.
It
I mean,
does.
I was
it
even
is special
saying,
red and yellow colors. Yeah.
McDonald's is ads even. I can't explain what it is, but their ads on television, they're cleaner, they're crisper, the colors are brighter. It's like...
Oh, you just want to love. You just want to love going there. You love wanting to go there. But, you know, the most telling thing for me is I don't have two-year-olds anymore, but my friends who do have two-year-olds, and these are friends who don't have a television set in the house, have never taken their kids to McDonald's, don't have junk food in the house,
right.
and they'll drive down the street and their two-year-old will say, take me to McDonald's. And they have no idea how their two-year-old knew about McDonald's. And they say, why do you want to go there? Oh, because the food is so good. How do you know the food is good? You've never eaten there. Mm-hmm. And they say, well, they just know. They know.
Yeah.
It's in the air.
Incredible. Absolutely astonishing.
It's in the water supply, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, schools also promote these snacks by having all these products in the vending machines at schools. I've seen it with my own eyes.
Oh, absolutely.
So how do they, I mean, how do these guidelines address marketing through, you know, availability in schools?
Oh, no, those are different guidelines. These are just advertising guidelines, but in every possible way, the food industry wants those vending machines in schools. Mm-hmm. I, you know, vending machines didn't always used to be in schools.
There were no vending machines when we were in school.
Right. And they came in the 1990s, and the food marketers will do anything they can. They'll do anything to keep those machines in schools, because the research shows that the more machines there are, the more products kids buy. And what I think that does is, from the school standpoint, it sends a message to the kids that this is normal to eat.
Yeah, it's normal.
This is what you're supposed to eat. It's normal.
It's even desirable, possibly. Because mm-hmm. here we are. We're at school. We're promoting it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
now,
exactly.
Do you think like a second Obama administration would be the time for him to do such things? I mean, when do social changes like this historically happen? I mean, does something have to happen to get Congress, or does the president have to be very powerful? Like,
something has happened. We have an enormous obesity epidemic in this country that's going to have an enormous effect on healthcare costs. You would think that that would encourage Congress to sit down and think about what they might do to prevent this problem that is going to have such a tremendous impact on healthcare costs when healthcare costs are completely out of control. But the politics of this is so nasty that when I talk to people in the Obama administration, they say, we have to work with the food industry. The minute I hear that, a red flag goes up in the air, and I know we're not going to get anywhere on this.
So you think that in spite of all of the, you know, let's move campaign of Michelle Obama and planting mm-hmm. the garden and all that jazz, basically they have knuckled under to the food lobby.
They truly believe that they must work in partnerships and alliances with the food industry.
Well, you must agree with that, though. I mean, because it's trying to get those ones to change, no? I mean, or do you want to see them?
I think they need to be regulated. Uh-huh. I don't care if they sell junk food. They can sell as much junk food as they want to. They cannot market it to children. That's unethical.
Yeah.
And they need to be regulated. Period. End of story. They cannot market that stuff to children. To me, it seems open and shut. It's simple as can be. It's just a question of ethics. Kids are not capable of doing critical thinking around marketing. There's loads of research that shows that.
Yep.
So you need regulation for that. Why are you playing? Why are you in bed with them?
Yeah, why are children being sacrificed?
Why are children being sacrificed? Precisely. Yeah. You know, you want the food industry to do something. Well, let's not talk about voluntary guidelines. Let's talk about limits.
Yeah. I couldn't agree with you more, but that's okay. But if the Kellogg's of the world are working so hard to get away from, you know, to press down on these regulations, what about the corn lobby and ancillary businesses? Are they all working together? Do you have, I mean, since most of these, for instance, snack foods are corn-based products.
Yes.
I mean, the corn lobby has already demonstrated that it's got a lot of power in the government in terms of, you know, pay for it with Congress or not. So how much are these guys working together, or is it like actually are they still working separately and yet towards the same goal?
What do you think
is happening?
For the most part, they work separately. And all you have to do is look for the self-interest. It's really easy to analyze. You just, you know, you look at the industry and you say, what is in this industry's self-interest? And that's where it's going to put its lobbying dollars. It's not all that complicated. And when the goals are congruent and are the self-interests overlap, then they work together. When they're not, they work in opposition. The most obvious one being the difference between the sugar lobby and the corn refiners.
Yeah.
The corn refiners represent high fructose corn syrup. The sugar lobby represents the producers of cane and sugar beets. And they're at complete loggerheads. They're fighting each other all the time.
Well, I think everybody has seen the ads that have started to pop up now with from the sugar lobby or from the whatever the sugar trade group is. But they say, it's from the corn lobby where it says the high fructose corn syrup is your body perceives it as exactly the same product as sugar from beets or from cane. And so therefore, there's no difference between the two. And so therefore, you should just go right ahead and keep consuming as much high fructose corn syrup as you can. And even you have said the same, Marion.
Well, the science is there, but the politics are not. Sugar is sugar. And I think we need to eat less of both of them. But what I find hilarious is the corn refiners want to change the name of high fructose corn syrup to corn sugar, and this is hugely opposed by the sugar lobby. I think that's really funny.
Would things taste worse in your world? Like, is it possible to take out sugar, for instance, from breakfast cereals and still make them taste delicious to kids?
I think you can add your own sugar.
Right. Yeah, that's what we did when we were kids.
And you would be adding a lot less than what's in there to begin with. I like sugar.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm not in any way opposed to sugar. It has a place in American diets and a very important one. You just don't have to eat so much of it. You know, Americans consume or use 120 pounds per capita of sugars and corn sweeteners and different kinds of caloric sweeteners a year. That seems excessive. Mm-hmm. That's a third of a pound a day per capita, which means adults, teenagers, little tiny babies. Ooh. That seems like a lot.
That's pretty scary.
Pollen said 9 ounces of meat a day. That's what people eat. The average American eats 9 ounces.
Those who eat meat.
That's not quite a pound.
You're not fighting against that, are you? Because that personally hurts.
No, not at all.
No, just kidding.
I believe that meat has a place in American diets.
I do, too.
Probably not 0.9 ounces.
I do want to talk for a second about breakfast foods, which I personally don't like and never have. Even as a child, I didn't like them.
You don't like fish either.
No, I don't. and so breakfast cereals, since we're talking about sweeteners and the use of breakfast cereals, and of course the cereal lobby and Kellogg's, heavily, advertise about how important it is to get a good healthy meal. Mm. There's breakfast cereal, which is always loaded with sugars. There's things like Pop-Tarts, toaster strudels, Eggo waffles. What about all of these foods? I mean, I don't see them as packing any kind. I mean, I feel like you might as well feed your kid a cookie or a cupcake.
Or a
basically
power bar.
Has the same,
They're all the same.
Yeah. I mean, there's no nutritional benefit to consuming an Eggo waffle, right?
Oh, there's some nutritional benefit. Don't exaggerate.
What about
there's some nutritional
there's
benefit.
There's an energizing effect.
Yeah, I mean, it's got, you have to eat some calories, yeah.
Yeah, it's got calories. It's got, usually these things are vitamin and mineral fortified, so you get a vitamin pill with them.
That's actually a big ad campaign now. I've noticed a lot of the cereals, logos or like Lucky Charms character coming and meeting the other logos and proudly saying that they now meet all these vitamin requirements. Mm. And they're really marketing almost like a pharmaceutical, like it's a health thing.
Yeah, I mean, you could give your kid a vitamin pill and take care of that much more easily and probably better. But this is the result of an enormous marketing campaign to establish cereal as breakfast. But I mean, the sugary sweetened cereals for kids are defined as what kids are supposed to eat for breakfast. So nobody thinks about it. That's what you give your kid. And it's not like oatmeal where you actually have to cook it. Oh, what a concept.
Oh my God, even if it's in the microwave.
Yeah. it dirties something. Yeah.
Instead of having one of those convenient little plastic bowls where you just pop off the top and pour the milk in?
Yeah, I mean, I just see this as a result of marketing to try to convince people that this is normal, healthy, fair for breakfast. And the cereal industry argues forcefully that if kids weren't eating their cereal, they wouldn't be getting any nutrition in the morning at all. And, they may not be wrong. I've certainly seen kids going to school eating potato chips or something that's...
How is a potato chip worse than a bowl of cereal?
Oh, it's got fewer vitamins in it.
Does it?
These are marginal differences.
That's what I'm thinking. I can't believe you really want
kids eating food, but families feel like they don't have time to do breakfast. I mean, this is all... complicated social stuff.
Yeah.
But for people who want to feed their kids, feed your kid food.
Right.
What a concept.
Yeah. What a
what a concept. Well, that's very interesting. We should probably take our first break, but this is very interesting. I want to know, I mean, do you ever feel like someone's following you from the sugar lobby?
Or the corn lobby?
Keep an eye out.
We'll be right back with Dr. Marion Nessel. We are back. This is The Main Course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, with my friend and partner in crime, Patrick Martins. Our guest today is Dr. Marion Nessel, who is a radical thorn in the side of the food industry, I suspect. Patrick was asking just before the break, do you get followed, Marion? You know, I could see it happening, actually. I really could. One of those little, like, you know, spy versus spy type guys.
Unfortunately, the guy following her is often obese and can't sustain a six-block walk. Yeah.
Can't keep up with Marion, who is slender and clearly in very good shape. But we were talking about breakfast a little bit, and I wanted to say that in the Times Magazine section today, you know, the magazine about the, and it had all these lovely little sections, one of them was the history of breakfast foods. And so what I observed, and also having read tons of old cookbooks in my lifetime, breakfast used to be leftovers. It was leftover pie. It was leftover, you know, meat. It was leftover whatever. And often they wouldn't even bother to heat it. They would just go for it. And then later on, when the cereal industry started, you know, gearing up, which would be like the late 19th, early 20th century, really, right? Wasn't that when Kellogg's and General Mills and all that kind of stuff started?
Kellogg's gave me Xerox copies of the boxes of three different kinds of cereals dating back to the beginning.
No kidding.
And these cereals started in the 20s.
Wow.
Most of them.
Yeah. Well, people thought that they were the new health food. I mean, that was sort of when health food started.
Did they feed people during the Depression? I mean, had they mass marketed then at that point?
They were already starting. Some of that, you know, during the Depression, I don't know what people ate. They just ate whatever they could. They didn't have any money.
Because, I mean, at that point, a breakfast cereal, you could imagine being a very good thing. I mean, it would get, I mean, when it's all about calories, you know, then the cereals, if they were everywhere.
It was wheat and it was advertised for its laxative properties.
Oh, really?
They stopped that after a while.
But they still advertise fiber, and which is basically, that's what we're talking about.
Property.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I mean, I remember when that came in, and also the whole claim that oats were good for your cholesterol, and everything had to have oats in it.
Yeah,
that's what Michael Pollan said in the New York Times Magazine.
Oh, is that right?
Oatmeal would be his number one breakfast food.
Yeah, I mean, oatmeal makes total sense to me because it's high fiber, and you add protein in the form of milk to it, and it sticks to your ribs.
Like a Zamboni, you know, just going down, clearing everything in its path.
Well, it's got a you know, stick to your ribs quality,
and throw a little brown sugar in it. And it's quite good.
Or a banana.
Or a banana.
Let a banana cook in it.
And Michael Pollan said, let it soak overnight. And then when you get there in the morning, it's like perfect.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah. Then you don't have
are
to cook
it. Are those steel
as
cut oats?
Yeah, he steel uses cuts. Steel cut oats.
Yeah, yeah. That's a whole different ball
they
of wax.
They require cooking.
Yes, they really do. Of course, grits are my favorite.
Mm.
I'm a grits fan. One of the other things in the Times Magazine was a little piece about addictive, whether foods are addictive or whether it's just craveability, which is what the industry would like to think. So do you think, Marion, that people get literally addicted to, you know, sugar, fat, salt, sweet, you know, that incomparable combination that, for instance, pizza, like really good, really greasy pizza will give you that perfect.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge argument right now. I think of addiction as something, you know, alcohol, cigarettes, or drugs, or something
caffeine.
Like that. Or not even caffeine so much. And you're out of control. And I mean, there are many aspects of food that are like addiction, but not to the same extent.
Chocolate?
So it's not that level of craving. And although foods stimulate the same pleasure centers that all of these other things stimulate, it's to a lesser extent. A lot of people think they're addicted to sugar or things
I mean, I think there's evidence of people's addiction all around us in the obesity epidemic. Can you say that that's not an addiction? As you look at your body balloon out of control, you feel crummy, you can't, you know, and you can't stop eating. I mean, isn't that an addiction?
Yeah, I think it's much more complicated than that, because people are so influenced by the environment of food choice. For example, at Roberta's, where we ate before we came here, I ordered the ricotta pancakes expecting little tiny things an inch and a half across and got something quite enormous that I ate quite a lot of.
But you didn't finish your plate. I thought that showed admirable self-restraint.
That wasn't self-restrained. I was at the end of what I could. I was at the absolute end.
So, I mean, portions do get... a restaurant also has the challenge to, you know, really want people to come there because they feel stuffed. They feel satisfied. So if there's a low food cost item and you can serve a lot of it, that seems to be in their best interest.
Well, I think it's probably easier to make one pancake than it is to make a lot of little teeny ones.
Yes, of course.
True, too. Yeah. Silver. They used to call those silver cup pancakes.
Silver dollars,
at the coffee shops.
Yeah,
and absolutely. I don't know why, but that's what I thought I was getting.
Well, you'll have different expectations next time.
I love it how in restaurants like this, you can be like, could we get silver dollar pancakes? They'd be like, absolutely not. There's a recipe. And like, Franny's, they'd be like, no, you cannot substitute your sausages on your pizza. I'm like, why?
Yes, they seem very firm about those things here.
No substitutions.
It's the people who ask for substitutions in fast food restaurants that I always find really astonishing. I mean, my daughter was describing something like that to me recently, where she was standing behind somebody at Chipotle and they were saying, but could I have this instead of that? And, you know, blah, blah, blah. And the guy's looking at her. He doesn't speak English, really. And I mean, it's just like, there's a line of people around the block. But
Chipotle is all about choice. I want this.
Well, let's talk quickly about that as a fast food option. I mean, somebody who knows her nutrition, what do you think about the new fast food chains that are springing up, like Chipotle? I wish there were more of them, but like Chipotle or In-N-Out Burger or some of the other Five Guys, I think, has claims to better quality ingredients and so
Chipotle
on.
Chipotle has terrific ingredients, but I think it's an obesogenic environment. It
really
promotes eating more because you pay the same amount of money no matter how big your portion is, and so there's an incentive to pile as much food on your plate as you can possibly do. Make your burrito as big as possible, the size of a small baby, as Betty Fussell likes to call it. And so it's, you know, the food is good, but there's no incentive to eat less or to control the portion size. That doesn't make it easy for people.
No, I suppose not. But at least the quality of the ingredients is better.
Although, please never take up against the churrascaria. I always want to maintain that importance, but that's a glutton zone.
Yeah, I mean, just because the ingredients are delicious and carefully raised doesn't mean they don't have calories. Alas, they do.
Alas, they do, as do all things. Now, Marion, you are engaged in a very... Speaking of calories.
Speaking of calories. What a coincidence.
What a coincidence. You are engaged in a fabulous new project that's going to be coming out when? This is a new book in March?
Is coming out in March. My partner Mal Nesheim and I spent the last couple of years writing a book about calories. Okay. And it's called Why Calories Count, From Science to Politics. And we expect to get the galleys next week, and it's coming out in March.
That's very exciting. Who's your publisher?
California Press, excellent. University of California. Uh-huh.
Katie, is this when you ask if you can write the quote for the back?
Yeah.
Just get that in there now.
Let me self-aggrandize just a tiny
you
bit.
You want to blurb the book? We'll
I've already,
send you one.
You're like
co-founder of the main course.
Yeah. No, but so why do calories count? Let's hear, what's the point? What's the point of the book?
Everybody's worried about obesity, and we think it's about calories. It's really not that complicated. If you want to control your weight, you have to eat less, move more, do both, preferably eat less.
Now, can you eat like a ton of food, but just exercise like crazy every day and be okay? I mean, is that, what's wrong with that?
If you're a competitive...
Because that's kind of how I am.
Yeah, if you're a competitive bicycle rider... If you're a competitive runner, uh-huh, and you're really a cross-country skier and you're doing that all the time, then you can really eat a lot. If you're an ordinary person who's just walking here and there, you're going to overeat if you're trying to eat a lot.
So you do think it's okay to have like hamburgers and high calorie, you know, as long as it's not really lowest quality stuff, but to really bring in tons of calories as long as you work it off?
If you can, but most people can't.
Yeah.
Most people aren't competitive athletes.
Well, I mean, you know, you're saying you have to be a competitive athlete. What about going regular people who go to the gym 3 times a week?
Or someone who jogs 15 miles a week.
Yeah, I mean, that's 1,500 calories. I mean, the rule is, on average, a mile is 100 calories.
Oh,
if you're a small person, it's going to be
less. I'm going to write that. Jack, tag that, even if you don't think you should.
If you're
1 mile equals
this is 100 calories. 100 calories. This is a ballpark figure. For somebody who's much bigger, it'll be 150. For somebody who's much smaller, it'll be 50.
Translate calories as you best can into pounds.
An Oreo, 3,500 for a pound.
Wow.
So, you know, and
so
an,
I have to run
and,
like
and
10
an Oreo
times
cookie,
as much.
And an Oreo cookie is 50 calories.
I can run 50 miles a day.
So if you're, it's really easy. Yeah, you can. It's really easy to overeat calories. Really, really easy to overeat, and very, very hard to work them off.
But what like if you don't eat things like Oreo cookies? I mean, I never eat cookies.
Yeah, I just eat bread and meat. That's my
That'll do it.
That'll do it too.
And we drink.
Oh, that'll do it too. Unfortunately, the saddest thing in the world, alcohol calories count.
All
I know,
things,
it really stinks.
Really
I've been
do.
On the vodka diet for months now. It's really been great for me.
Vodka? That has no taste.
Vodka and seltzer. Yeah, I add whatever. You know me. Yeah.
It doesn't
I doctor it up.
You're like, taste doesn't matter.
But wine is much more calorific.
No.
You can drink... I mean, I can drink a bottle of wine in a sitting. Okay.
I can only drink
a couple of...
Mitchell Davis, the vice president of the James Beard Foundation, has a show called Taste Matters. Maybe you could say taste doesn't matter when it comes to drinks. Policy with Katie Kiefer. I like that.
Oh, yeah.
I like the way that sounds. It has a nice ring to it.
Oh, that's really enticing. Very seductive. That's what we're looking for here, yeah.
Well, this has been great. Now, we have, you know, our next guest, which we'd love for you to sit in on, because she really, by the definition of what she does, directly combats the whole elitist issue, because they're serving very filling meat sandwiches with the side for like $6, $7. So like bona fide 100% less than a value meal.
Yep.
And there's two other places, and they're, of course, using the lesser cuts and this and that. So we'd love for you to stay if you can, but we're going to wind up with Dr. Nessel and soon bring on Michelle. But thanks so much for coming on, Marion.
My pleasure.
Always a pleasure to have you. It's
we
been
learned
great.
So much.
Pleasure
I
to
felt
here.
Today in particular, we really distilled a lot of things.
Yeah. So stay tuned. We'll be right back with more news from the meatball shop.
I know a girl who's had too many ups and downs, settled lots of drama, and she's a cast off clown. And I shake my head as she begins to run from everything she hides from everyone. How long will you be able to hide from all the beauty in your life? I wish
we're back on the main course, broadcasting out of Roberta's, 261 Moore Street. In the studio, we have Michelle Petrullio. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Yes, Michelle Petrullio.
And you are the head chef at the Meatball Shop on Bedford Avenue, which is a very, very interesting place. We actually keep bringing the Meatball Shop up for a number of reasons over the course of the season because of, you know, its menu. So just to familiarize our listeners who don't know, can you tell us about your menu?
Yes, absolutely. You know, obviously it's based on the meatball. But what we do there is, you know, it's a build your own menu. And from top to bottom, you can choose your sauces, your balls, your sides, etc. But what we try to focus on is using a quality product that's accessible to most of the public. Something that none of us felt like was happening often enough today. And we focus on, you know, trying to support local farmers, you know, trying to keep it fun, trying to make it a place where people want to go and actually eat good food at a decent price.
Well, building your menu is definitely a way to do that. So describe what that means exactly. So someone will come and there's any one of a choice of like what? 5 or 7 meatballs?
Yeah. On a daily basis, we have 4 balls and then a day ball, which is sometimes matched with the sauce.
God, you must have some crazy jokes at the in the kitchens.
I work with...
Tell us some of the best ones.
You know, I actually block most of them out at this point because, let me see here. Well, we have the naked balls. We have... you know,
the wrinkled.
It's just ridiculous. Like, these balls look dry. It's just like, it's just from beginning to end, it's just, you know, and I work with a bunch of guys who just, they cannot help themselves at all. And I've never said balls so much in my life. And, you know, it's really.
So, balls to the wall on balls.
Balls to the wall, right? It takes some getting used to.
Yeah.
And then
you guys are real ballers.
Ballers,
yep. When it comes to balls.
Yep. Yeah. Be careful with those balls. Those balls are delicate. Bing, bing, bing.
Balls are falling apart.
Yep.
So, well, anyway, so you have 4 balls on the menu at one time, but it's more of a menu than that, right? Because you also combine sides and
yes, and we have, it's actually 5 balls because we have the
day ball.
The day ball, yeah. We have sides. We have, you know, polenta. We have risotto. We run a daily green, a roast veg, a market salad. Those things change, you know, accordingly. It's market driven. And the steadies, you know, like I mentioned, are the polenta. We have spinach. We have broccoli. Like I said, the risotto. Beans, mashed potato, and you can choose those, you know, you can build it. Our menu is, it's given to you with a, it's laminated, and then you're given a dry erase marker. So you can have it under, you can have it on the side, you can basically build whatever you want. We have a, we have a white, a wheat hero, or you can do a smash bun, which is a brioche bun, you can do sliders, you know, so it's,
I hear sliders are never as good, like burger was meant to be cooked as whatever it is, a 6-7 ounce ones. Once you split it up, it loses something. Is that,
you know, sure? It's interesting because, you know, as the person who builds the sliders, we like to say that I would like to say they're not good because they're a pain to get, you know, 25 sliders at once. You're like, really? But then, you know, I ate one, you know, like you just never eat your complete product sometimes. And I ate one and I thought, I would
good.
Order that. It actually works really well with a meatball.
I just wonder, like, surface area to inside, you know, then the slider turns that into a third, you know, and I always wonder if there's
a texture
issue. Or...
You know, I can see where you're, you know, going with that. I have experienced that before, but I think that, like, we've really found a nice, like, the size, like, the portion size of the meatball. With the bun that we get, we seem to have accomplished like the right, you know, the right feel for it. It's like you're actually tasting a mini version of what you want it to be.
Well, let's talk about cost for a second. I mean, what does it cost to, you know, provide a good nutritious meal. I mean, Katie, you've been talking about that for a long time, right? Cooking at home and
versus buying fast food.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
how would you position them with cooking at home? Because what is an average meal cost at the meatball shop? Like, if you were to get,
if you got a hero and a side, that would be $13.
$13. You know?
Okay, so
still
you're getting
more
bread, you're getting meat, and you're getting whatever your side dish is, hopefully a vegetable of some
sort.
Yep,
and a
right?
simple salad with the hero that is, you know, arugula and apples.
So that's four more dollars than a value meal.
Yeah.
And equal to a movie.
Right. Oh, right. Cheaper than a movie.
Cheaper than a movie.
How much is the brioche bun, though?
Yeah.
Isn't that cheaper?
Is the, do you get, Jack is asking, do you get a discount if you order it on a brioche bun? Does it get any cheaper?
Yeah, well, yes.
Oh, Jack!
The smash is, because it's only two balls instead of three, and it's $8.
How many ounces are the balls?
The balls, see, here we go. It's
how big are your balls? Sorry. I can't stop myself.
they're right around 2 ounces right before we
2 ounces.
Roast them.
Yep. So you get two or three in an order?
Mm-hmm.
So
or four if you get nakeds.
Nakeds.
Just balls.
Oh my God, stop it.
It's ridiculous.
I mean, four is a normal order then, right?
Four, yeah. The naked ball
so
is really popular, you know. Yeah. And it's like, I mean, you know, it's the real deal. If you
it's
get a hero
pound.
And a side,
yeah.
you're going to be quite full.
And it's so interesting. It uses basically trim. Or it's just about a fat ratio, right? Does it matter what goes into that fat ratio, or can it really be anything? Like, could you use hanger or sirloin or ham or Boston butt?
I mean, you could do anything because, you know, you're playing with binders and you control your liquid. You can, how much bread you put in, how much egg. And, you know, if you have a lot of wet ingredients, then you can, you know, supplement. Yeah, here. Yeah.
My mind
you know,
is
so
wet
balls. You can, you know, spinning, you can, yeah. you Mushy. Can end up making anything. You know, we have a steak, bacon, and cheddar right now.
And there's no really? Texture difference if you use completely different cuts. As long as you, because you're breaking everything down, you can basically reconstruct it to be the same no matter what cuts.
Yes. Yes, I would say so. You know, because you can also control, you know, you have the different dyes on the Hobart, on the grinder. So, you know, texturally, you can pretty much, you know, accomplish anything.
A Hobart, huh?
Oh, yeah.
They're the best. That's what I've been told.
The grinder,
We have a 47-year-old Hobart.
At the meat shop, they were like, get Burkel or Hobart.
Yeah.
We ended up going with, like, two, you know, not the nice Burkels, the electric ones, but those are the two best.
Michelle, what are the standard mixes that you use? What's your standard meatball? Do you have a standard meat? I guess I should ask.
You mean percentage of fat?
Well, no, but like, you know, traditionally meatball mix was like when they sell it in the grocery store, it's veal, pork, and beef.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Okay. So what's your, do you guys have a standard mix or do you change them up all the time?
Well, I mean, you know, we have the set ingredients for, you know, the balls we run all the time, but it's not like the beef, they all have pork, you know, some amount of pork in them. Besides the veggie ball, you know, but the beef is almost, it's beef, chicken, pork, and, you know, each of those balls are, you know, primarily just that ingredient, you know, with a small amount of pork fat or whatever mixed in, because, you know, pork is pork. Pork has flavor.
Well, pork fat, especially, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's not your traditional meatball, you know, in that sense of the veal pork mix.
Earlier in the show, Patrick was talking about how much he enjoyed eating a goose recently.
Oh, my God.
And it just occurred
Don't
to me that, like, a goose
it.
Meatball, because the goose fat, of course, is so flavorful and delicious, and the meat is kind of like red meat. I mean,
I think, you know, we've sold 500 goats across the country for Goat-tober.
Yeah, there's the goat ball.
My personal goal is to push duck and goose. I literally took it out of the cryo, rinsed it in water, and put it onto, I didn't really have a thing to catch a fat, so I put it over muffin pan, a muffin pan, so it just caught all the juices.
Oh, nice.
And I didn't do anything. I think I might have sprinkled a little bit of salt on the top. It came out. By the way, it cooks in like a half hour.
Awesome.
It's unbelievable. 40 minutes at 400. Yeah, it's really? So fat because it's a thin bird, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I found out David Copperfield or whatever, were those old movies. Or no, Scrooge, you know, yeah. Charles Dickens' thing. Mm-hmm. The goose was actually the poor person's food, and the turkey was if you were doing a little bit better. So it was really the poor man's food, and I guess because it was so thin. But man, that it has back fat. That's just like you cut the breast, and there's a thick quarter inch. I mean, if pigs, you don't really do that with. I don't know. I just cut off the little bit of fat, but that I'm eating the skin, the fat. It's just so succulent.
It's unbelievable, really.
Unbelievable, and I did nothing to it, but.
That's a
well, talking about using lesser cuts, I mean, that's really the big thing you guys do because it almost doesn't matter what cuts you use. That makes you guys awesome to work with, certainly from Heritage Foods and for farmers to work with because you'll always, as long as the percentages are right, you can always take almost anything.
Sure, which is, you know, it's just, it's funny to me like how, you know, in New York especially, we like flip a switch on what's cool and what's all the time. You just watch it go around. It's almost like, you know, it's cyclical to like, you know, the wealthy and the poor neighborhoods. Everything switches and it just goes through its, you know, and the different cuts of meats have changed a lot, you know, and as far as what people prefer. And I mean, you know, anything that's run through a grinder or served in a loaf is usually, you know, deemed as like, you know, peasant food, so to speak. But it's actually just like, I mean, it's a wonderful way to use product, you know. I mean, if you treat it properly and you, you know, seasoning and you keep it, you know, simple but quality, you know, you're gonna make a good product. And I think that, you know, Meatball Shop accomplishes that. You know, most restaurants that do that, Roberta's here, you know, they just respect the ingredient and, you know, that's usually... it does most of the work for you.
Are you going to open like a dozen more around the country?
87. No, actually, I'm not really sure, you know. I'm not... Daniel and Michael, you know, they're enjoying what they've got going right now, and I think they just kind of... You know, like, for right now, we... Bedford Ave is the focus, and they feel, you know, lucky in every sense of the word.
Because that place is pumping. It is so much fun, like... You want to go for graduation or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just fun, you know.
Yeah.
Loud, light, quick service, you know, delicious food. You're picking your own. Well, I mean, do you ever fear, like, that if you guys grow too fast, you'll have a historical collapse, like the Red Sox kind of collapse?
Wow.
By going 7-7. And 20? No, I'm sorry.
It's ridiculous.
That you had to go through that. I know you're a big
Sox.
Sports fan.
They're my Red Sox.
We were talking about that earlier. I mean, let's talk a little bit about your roots, you know, as we wind up and like what brought you to be a chef here. I mean, Red Sox, New England, passion, small restaurants, doing right by your employees. I mean, you sounded pretty strong about those things.
Well, you know, I went... all of us there came from my sous chef, great guy, Dabri Zenedin. He and Mitch Barr, Daniel, we all came from fine dining. And I just, you know, I was working with great people, but I just reached a point where I thought, you know, this isn't really how I grew up, you know, feeding, you know, 8% of the population that can afford it, you know. And I started to... I didn't enjoy the vibe, you know. I didn't enjoy that it wasn't accessible. It was very elitist, and, you know, I wasn't enjoying environments where, like, you know, tough love and chefs that are yelling, and, you know, I think happy people make happy food. You know, I grew up in New England with, you know, hot dogs and lobster steamed, that's it, with butter, you know, and those were the best meals of my life.
Rhode Island.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what it was all about. And it had more to do with the people you were with and the time you were spending and what you were around. It had as much to do with it as the food. And I happened upon these guys. I knew Michael a little bit, and... they immediately just, you know, treated me really well, and they treat their employees really well, and we try to have a good time there. And
is there never any yelling? I mean, it must get in the crazy moments, right?
Yes.
I mean, it must be hard to keep that philosophy going all the
time. There's also been moments where I'm like, well, that's why they do it. Because, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, you're also trying to, you know, keep your quality up. And you have to, you know, at some time, you know, you have to be stern and, you know, all that. But, you know, it's all on the premise of, like, let's just work in a way that we can be proud of. And if we're all doing that, then we're going to leave you alone. You know, it's just a matter of like that. It's a give and take, and we like to work in sort of an honor system. I mean, that's the goal. But have I gotten extremely angry? Yes. You could go into the restaurant, and of course, I've had my moments. You know what I mean? How could you not? It's a high stress environment. But
so, what are your greatest challenges as running a restaurant? I mean, how many employees would you say work at Brooklyn?
I think we have like 9. Or 12 line cooks. So I don't know, probably about 20 or 25 kitchen back of the house related.
And you're the head guy. I mean, you're the head person there. So, I mean, what are the big challenges of your biggest challenges in terms of inspiring and controlling and keeping quality up, delegating? I mean, all those kind of magic.
I think the biggest challenge for me is to not become so involved in my own moment that I can't take it from the perspective of them. Because, you know, the reality is, you know, everyone's trying to reach a common goal. And if I lose sight of, you know, what their day might be like, or if I lose sight of the fact that, like, you know, not everyone is a 38-year-old and this is their entire life, and you need to find a way to, like, you know, remember that, you know, and to remember that, you know, every person there has a hand in it and is equally as important. I mean, it can sound really corny, but it seems like, you know, you have to keep respect for other people. And I think managing to keep that in check is sometimes, you know, it sometimes is just really hard. It's really easy to just kind of start saying, you know, it's all about me, the pressure, the deliveries and whatnot. But in the end, it's just meatballs, and you got to get your grip. I mean, you can't just like really, like I've stopped at some point and been like, wait a minute. It's just meatballs, you know, and I think that's important, you know.
I also say that running Heritage Foods and the meat shop,
yeah,
it's just meatballs. But I like that. Ronaldo used to call me a meatball. Remember Ronaldo? He's like, you meatball. I mean, it was once a word of derision. So I like that you've taken back meatball. And you know, given it a happier.
We try. Life. Yep.
So now, any Christmas specials or anything, people just go, you can reserve. You want to give a website?
Yeah, I mean, meatballshop.com. We have Facebook. We have Twitter. We have, you know, we have a meatball for every occasion. Like, we'll have our turkey ball. We have bunny balls. We had bunny balls.
Daniel just tuned out. He's like, she said it. She said the thing she was supposed to say. We have a meatball for every occasion.
It's true. I mean, we have like we have our stuffing balls and stuff coming up for Thanksgiving. And awesome. Yeah,
can someone send food ahead to you and say, or have a request, put in a request, for instance, since I want to have a party for 50 people, mm-hmm. but I want it to be all done with this wild boar that I shot upstate. I'll deliver you the boar, grind it up, and, you know, even if you charge them $10,000, have you ever done anything like that?
Oh, God, don't give people ideas.
That's Meatball Shop. That's in questions at Meatball Shop.
Right? Anything you want, anytime. Michelle's got it. No, it's...
That would be cool, though, if someone could bring their own meat.
Yeah, sure. To a restaurant. I mean, it would be awesome. I mean, we love getting, you know... We love having people give ideas. It's awesome. It helps us, you know. I mean, I get stuck in, like, my little ball world. And I see, you know, it's like...
You get balled up.
You know, I'm wondering when my pork is arriving. And it's like, you start running out of ideas. It's like anything. You know what I mean?
If only you had a crystal ball.
If only I had a crystal ball.
Wow. Well, why don't we... maybe we will take a very short break and... Katie, I have to ask you in the final 3 minutes of the show what you think about the logo, the new logo for the main chorus with the big golden arch, but we'll talk about that in a second.
Okay. Well, we're back, so I'm very excited about this because we have a new website, which was such a great group of people helped put that together. I mean, Jack led the effort, Jack Inslee. He's really doing such a great job running this station. I swear to you, Jack, one day we'll pay you more than minimum wage. Thanks, I swear to God. Someday.
Thanks.
And no, but it's just, you know, from the kid. What is the kid's name who did it again, Josh?
John McGill, a.k.a. my best friend.
John McGill. Yeah,
our best friend.
I will be a clarion for John for the rest of my life because we literally had such a sophisticated search engine that we could not find someone to make these changes. No one knew about it. We never used the traditional Google search engine. We created our own. So it was good in that it was unique, but it was very difficult because it was very hard. And this kid totally figured it out. He busted his ass for 2 months for this, and the site looks fantastic. I want to thank Andrea for helping design it, you, Katie, for helping. Anyway, everyone should go onto the site. It's awesome. And what else do I want to say? We are now going to, I'm really proud of this because we're trying to make the station better and you're super into policy and you always want to have policy people on.
Yeah.
I'm super into chefs because I work with them and I force them to buy things like goat and geese.
Right.
So, you know, I make it up to them by having them on the station. And so we're going to kind of turn the main course into a two-part beast. So the main course will stay the main course, and then
with
yours,
Patrick Martins,
and yours will be.
Well, at the moment, my working title is Food Stock,
and that's going to be 99% policy.
Yeah, it'll be policy issues. Yeah,
the more serious side, because you know I always felt I'm an entrepreneur, so you know the policy thing always makes me roll my eyes because I never think any of those guys are really watching the ship, watching the shop.
Whereas I'm like totally fascinated by the geekery of it all.
I mean, you're into long-term change. I'm into like seeing the next 5 years lend themselves to me eating better in my own city and other Americans eating better.
Our goals, I think, are the same, but we have different ways of going about it. So yeah,
and I can't wait to listen to your show, and I think I'm going to call my show The Main Course. Can I get in trouble by putting the big golden arch M for Maine?
Nope, not yet.
I just get a cease and desist letter, but what if they say, oh, well, we sent it.
As soon as you get a cease and desist letter, you know you have made it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, come on.
But what if I can't?
Any press is good press.
Jack, what if I don't get my mail that day? Then I have a lawsuit on?
You probably have 30 days to cease and desist. That's
but I don't know. What if I don't get the letter? What if the mailman screws up?
You know, I am putting the station at risk. We'll comply with whatever they tell us to do.
Yes, but what if we don't get the letter? You know what I'm saying? Like, they say we sent 4 letters, but they sent it to the wrong P.O. box. Anyway, we'll talk about these and other interesting issues on my show, and your show will be a lot better, and I'm sure get better viewers.
And my show will be starting on, I think my first one is October 16th. My guest is Kathy Gunst, who is both a cookbook author and also a Food Talk radio host in Boston on WBUR.
And so didn't she just win? She was named one of the top 25,000 food personalities in the history of the world.
Wow, she did.
I knew you were going to bring class to the station one day, Katie.
Always.
But thanks so much for being on, Michelle, and thanks so much for buying from us and putting up with our, you know,
with our ball talk.
With our ball talk and getting pork
from us.
And we recommend to all our listeners, definitely go to Meatball Shop. Bedford Avenue is so much fun. And Jack, great job engineering and great job on the website.
Meatball Shop also gets my stamp of approval.
Oh, really?
Whatever
Jack
that means.
Is
Jack
suffering from hubris, just like poor Odysseus, who took a 10-year journey because of hubris.
Oh, my goodness.
Good luck,
thanks,
Jack.
To our sponsors, White Oak Pastures, and thank you to Marion Nessel for her participation. We'll be right back.
for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market.
Every spring at the end of kidding season, goat dairies across the country are faced with the question of what to do with their male bucklings. Because on a dairy farm, there's no role for a male. Often the most economical thing for these farmers to do is to cull the animals at birth or ship them off to the commodity market. Heritage Foods USA is embarking on a new project, No Goat Left Behind, looking to step in and fill this niche by creating a marketplace for these male bucklings. Visit us at www.heritagefoodsusa.com to learn more and to reserve your goat this coming October.